listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolensky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax. Today we've got an awesome potluck for you. All kinds of, Scott was saying, there's a lot of really good questions. We do this once a month, and we got some really, really good questions. So thank you to everyone who submitted a question. If you have a question, we haven't said this in a while. If you have a question that you want us to answer, go to syntax.fm. Top right-hand corner, there is a button. You click the button, and actually, it's not a button. It's a hyperlink. So click on the hyperlink. You notice that nobody says hyperlink anymore, Scott?
I feel like you're right that people don't. It's a much cooler name. It's a hyperlink. Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite battle bots is named Hypershock. And I just love the word hyper for some reason. It invokes traveling through the tubes.
Yeah, exactly. So we will transport you, if you click on the hyperlink, to a form. You can ask your question. Go ahead and fill it out. So today we are sponsored by Sanity, which is a structured content CMS. Sentry does error exception and performance tracking. Third one is Vonage, does all the APIs for voice, video, and messaging in your app. We'll talk about them partway through the episode. How are you doing today, Scott?
Doing very good. Just hanging out. This is the second week of our kids being back in school, which has been pretty transformative for us. Last week, I managed to do just about 10,000 things. In addition to that, clean the whole house and deep scrub. And I'm like, oh man, this is what it feels like to have 40 hours a week to work is an incredible feeling here. I just doubled the amount of time that I have to work, and it's feeling pretty good.
That's amazing. Yeah. Don't you feel good when you're I feel like I'm an adult again and not just trying to keep my head above water?
We were it was just a whole year of cutting our time in half. So just to being able to take that deep breath now and being able to do that, it does. It feels so good.
Yeah. Awesome. So let's jump into the first question from Art Vandelay. Thank you for the Seinfeld reference.
He's an architect.
I think this question is for Scott, so I'll read it and let you answer. How do you handle a token refresh when multiple API calls are made at the same time? I.e., let's say you get a 401 and acquire a new token, but that will only be used for the first API call, while the other parallel APIs would still be using the old one and error out. This has caused me to sort of artificially limit the total requests made to be one. How do you deal with it? Thanks for answering. I love the show.
Yeah, I don't know if that's just for me, Wes. I think that could be for both of us. I think the crux of it here is you're dealing with multiple API calls, and one of them fails, right? I don't necessarily know about the token refresh that's happening. It seems like if you're issued a token for an API, it should be valid for a predictable amount of time. I can't imagine there's a situation where my token's getting revoked in between requests, unless of course I'm doing something against the terms of service of the API. I honestly don't know. So that might need to be a little bit more elaborated upon. But I think the main crux of the question is here, when you have multiple API calls that rely on each other, what do you do if one of them fails? And really, this is kind of the reason why a lot of people have been liking GraphQL in various ways recently, because you could do a lot of API calls with one call, right?
Yeah.
You're not having to get data and then go back and ask for more data. But typically how it works is that when you request data from an API, in the next request that you make relies on that data, you're checking to make sure that data did come back successfully before firing off the next one. So that's what I would do is let's say to use the YouTube API for an example, I hit the YouTube API and I say, give me all of the videos in this playlist. It doesn't give you the detailed views. It just gives you all of them. So then I get all of them and then I can loop over them. And with that data, before any other additional call goes off, I check to make sure that the data exists, is where I need it to be. And then I fire off the next call. And then I check to make sure the data came back correct. So that's really the crux of it, is if you're working with multiple calls that rely on each other, you need to make sure that the data is there in between and handle it correctly by either throwing or logging in the certain way that you need to handle it.
I'm just thinking about this a little bit more, and I've run into something similar with the GitHub API, where I needed, like, you have to ping the API with your tokens, and then it brings back to you a new token that's valid for...
Oh, like a timed...
Yeah, I think it was like a 5-10 minutes or something like that, and I was, like, running into a situation where, like, sometimes it would time out. So, like, how do you handle something like that? Maybe that's what this person is referring to. In that case, you would... have to catch the error. What would happen is you would get an unauthenticated error back from the server. You catch that, and then you have a set of APIs that will refresh the token, and then you go ahead and call that thing again. So basically, the logic in your application needs to be a little bit recursive in that if it fails, then you have to recall it again. And then you probably also have to have some sort of, like, try 6 times. Mm-hmm. And then if it keeps failing after the 6th time, then go ahead and nix it entirely, because, like, obviously this thing is not working.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It's definitely something that you do hit, whether or not it's in that exact circumstance or not, but with having, you know, data that relies on one data, whether that's a token or something, and then making another request.
Yeah, usually what I do also is just make a function that's asynchronous called getToken.
Yeah.
And inside of that function, you store reference to it, and you remember it, or you throw it in a variable that's outside the scope, and then you just return that thing immediately from that. But if it is older than however many minutes that you have, then because it's an asynchronous function and you wait it, you can do things like, okay, instead of immediately returning the token, now I'm going to go to the API and grab a new one and then return that. And that's really nice. Sometimes people don't know that, where even though it's a promise-based function, you can return immediately from it, and it will just immediately resolve.
So, next question is from Kyle Willard. He says, what service do you guys use for video storage and optimization? I'm currently building out a side project that requires some video hosting, and I figured I would ask the experts. Okay, so Kyle, I will mention that the service that I use, Mux, MUX.com, they are a sponsor of this show. However, I did use them before they sponsored the show.
They're a sponsor because Scott can't talk about how awesome they are.
Right. That's the same thing with an Netlify, right? It's like, oh, well, you're already talking about how awesome we are. You might as well, sponsor you for it. So don't take it with a grain of salt, because it is very, very, I don't know. I'm very, very genuine when I say Mux saved us a lot of time. And it's not the sponsorship dollars talking here. What I'm talking about really is that I tried a lot of services, from building out our own video on demand platform to with AWS and their whole VOD workflow, to having something like Bitmovin, which is a very popular platform. And then even things like Vimeo, or what we did with YouTube in the past. I know Wes uses Vimeo, so he can speak more on that. But the reason why I chose Mux is because so many of these other services, whether it is Bitmovin or the Amazon VOD solutions, they require you to do so much. For instance, Bitmovin, you have to have all your assets somewhere in an S3 bucket or some sort of Google storage. Either way, some sort of storage. Your data has to live already somewhere. Then you have to connect it. Then you have to tell Bitmovin all of the different types of formats and files you could possibly want it to have it. It's like, I don't need to make these choices. Here's what I want. I want me to upload video, and I want users to watch video, and I want them to be able to get the best possible quality. And so the reason why I chose Mux is because writing a video uploader to Mux was pretty trivial. You could also point it to an S3 bucket if you wanted. Writing the uploader was pretty trivial for me. And then once they're in the system, we just save all the data into our database, or we reference it. And then we use a player to just call it. And what Mux does is it always returns the right quality for the user, and it transcodes it if it needs to. It doesn't store video that we don't need. With Bitmovin, what I would have to do is point it to an AWS bucket and say, hey, you know what? I need 25 versions of this specific file for all of the different situations it could ever possibly need. Same with Azure. Azure has their own VOD thing. And it was just like, why am I pre-creating all of these? Also, why am I having to worry about...
You had to pre-create them with Azure, eh?
Yeah.
So it's not very really on demand then. It's not very VOD.
Well, that's the whole thing, is that even the AWS workflow for it, it creates them ahead of time. And what it does with the video on demand workflow, it sets up, 15 different Amazon services, of which if one of them breaks, you have to then, get under the hood to figure out what broke about it. But you have like 15 different you know, named Amazon services that if you're not an Amazon certified developer, you're not going to know all these services, you know, the Whozits connects to the Whatsits connects to the Theirsits and whatever. But what it does is it looks into a bucket, it creates again a folder with like 20 different versions of that same file, and then it stores all those different versions into a database. So now not only are you having to manage the videos, all of the different versions, you're also having to manage some new database of information to make sure that everything's up to date where everything is. With Mux, we just have, here's our API, here's our videos. We call it, that information comes back to us, and we don't have to worry about things getting out of sync. We don't have to worry about 18 different services connecting to each other. It's just that easy. If you wanted to go the easier way, there's a lot of other services, like what Wes uses is Vimeo. You can talk more on that. But there's like Wixia. Is that one of them? They were way too expensive for
Wistia.
Us. Wistia. Yeah.
Wistia.
Yeah. They were way too expensive for us, along with a lot of those other marketing platform services. So that's why we ended up going like a developer-focused one. It's focused on serving a lot of video.
Yeah, we did a whole show on hosting video. It's really interesting. It's a huge, huge area to get into. I heard from people that run, I probably spend like $20,000 a year on hosting video alone. And I'm a small fish compared to a lot of these big sites out there. So it really depends on what you need to do at the end of the day. Like, do you need users to be able to upload video, or is it just like Scott and I, once a month or once every couple of months, we have just like set videos that we need to upload and then go ahead and stream it into our platform. Mm-hmm. So I personally use Vimeo myself. It's awesome. You can't beat the price of the Vimeo plan. They have like unlimited bandwidth on a lot of their pro ones. You do have to read the terms of service, because if your thing is private and the videos are not publicly available on Vimeo, then you don't qualify for any of their like $200 a year plan. So that's where I'm spending like 20 grand a year on. It's just like raw bandwidth for Vimeo. And you have to like have a call with them and talk about rates and negotiate and things like that. And at the end of the day, Vimeo does all of the like streaming and quality degradation and improving, and it will stream 4K when the device can support it and the speed can support it. All that stuff is handled by both the Vimeo player as well as like the raw bandwidth. Is you can't beat the price. If you were to go to Amazon and buy raw bandwidth, especially like I have a lot of users from India, and bandwidth from or to India is very expensive, and Vimeo doesn't differentiate between India and North America, which is which is really nice. You know what Les Mills is, which is like the workout, body pump, all that stuff?
Never heard of it.
No? It's really popular here in Canada. All the gyms use, if you go do like a class, they do like Les Mills class, and they have like an at-home thing that's really popular because of COVID. And my wife subscribes to it and does like the workout videos online. And I was like, what do they use? And they're a huge platform. Mm-hmm. They use Vimeo, hosted on their own domain name. And you can't even tell that it's Vimeo via the player. But if you look at the code, you can say, I recognize these things here. This is Vimeo.
Yeah. If you were going for that type of solution, like a lot of people would be tuning between Wistia and Vimeo and those type of, it seems like an easy choice for Vimeo to me because of what you get.
Yeah, Wistia, and there's a couple other ones. Those are more like, Wistia to me is not like a Vimeo competitor.
Yeah.
It's like a MailChimp for video, you know, because they're for marketing people. I guess though, Vimeo also does have like a marketing leg to it. What else? There's Cloudinary. They're a sponsor of us as well. They, along with Images, they're known for. They also do
on-demand video too, I think. Like how Mux does it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty cool. Like you can on-demand generate thumbnails and generate different versions. So that's really good. I haven't looked at what their bandwidth pricing is, but that seems like a really good option as well.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's not bad. And we looked into it, but there was like some issues where we were uploading a video that was like too large for the UI. And like the way that the UI handled the video uploading was different than how it would handle it from uploading it from an API. And at some point we were just like, I don't know. We want to maybe specialize in something. And also there was Cloudflare, which I used briefly as well. I did like a bit of a tour.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. We used Cloudflare for a little bit, but you have to use a custom HTML element called a stream element that they just made up, and their JavaScript like replaces it, but it causes so many TypeScript issues. I was just like, I'm so annoyed with this thing because you have this like fake element. So your VS Code is complaining, everything's complaining that there's this fake element. And if the JavaScript doesn't load, here's this fake element in your code. It's kind of weird. I was a little bit annoyed by that, but the rest of their system was really nice. It was probably, you know, one of my favorite options to choose here. It didn't seem like Cloudflare cared about the service that much. It felt like it was like an offshoot service, but at the same time, it worked well.
They seem to be getting into a lot of different stuff right now. I would probably take a look at Cloudflare again in 6 months, a year, or something like that, because I bet it's going to get pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, lots of good options there. Go back to the video episode if you want to hear more about that. We could talk about video all day, but it's pretty neat.
All day.
Next question here from Eric Q. Hi, I'm trying to teach myself web development, but I'm having problems making up the logic for my personal projects. I would love to watch YouTube tutorials or look at other people's code in order to implement simple features to my website myself, but I've been feeling pretty stupid for not spending the time to think about it myself. I feel like I'm missing out on knowing how to solve a problem for myself, whenever I copy and paste other people's code and try to understand it afterwards, much love. Man, this is a simple one to me. This is totally normal. You will get much better at this as time goes on. It's just like one day you're copy pasting somebody else's code and you're 100% reliant on a library to do literally anything. Mm-hmm. And then before you know it, you start to become that person that goes like, I'd rather not use a library, but I'll write it myself, you know? And I don't know what happens in that time, but everybody does this. Everybody needs to lean upon other people's code for more than you're comfortable with. And then eventually you start to get to, I change it a little bit myself. I'm getting a little bit better. I can look at this and write the whole thing myself by just referencing it. And then before you know it, you think like, I'm not sure about React and I made my own framework that is much better.
Yeah.
100 times faster.
It does seem just like an evolution of your career, right? As you go, you just feel more comfortable with that. Like I just remember so many times when I would think like, all right, I got to do a slideshow for this client. Let me just look for a jQuery slideshow, you know, find the best one and drop it in there. And I never even considered building one myself. That was like not a thing that was in my head. It was like, oh, never mind. But like nowadays I'm like, we built a slideshow in one video in a Level Up tutorial series. It's like, well, yeah, it's actually way easier once you dive into it. But for so long, it just feels like this black box of mystery of who knows what's inside of this stuff. You know, I highly recommend that. I know you do this too, Wes, is that when you're trying to solve any sort of problem, really think about it from an outside non-code perspective, write comments that like step by step. Let's say you need to do a login or something. All right, what happens? Well, the password comes in to the function. And then what happens with that password? We need to check to make sure that the password is the same one that's in the database. Well, we use the compare function or whatever. Then check to make sure the user session is active. Then we return the user if the user's okay. That was very simplified. But the idea is that you just do step by step by step by step in plain English what it should do before even touching code. And that really helps me out tremendously to break it down into really small steps like that. Okay, so before we head on to the next question, let's take a quick break to talk about one of our sponsors today, which is Vonage.
Yes, Vonage is probably no Vonage, but they have some really cool stuff that maybe you don't know about them, in that they have a whole bunch of APIs for doing cloud communication that allow you, the developer, to integrate things like voice, video, SMS, chat, messaging. What I'm looking here, the user authentication, user identity. Basically, they have a whole bunch of APIs that make building the hard parts of your app really, really easy. So if you want to integrate like video, like Scott and I are talking over Zoom right now, if you wanted to integrate that into your app, you go ahead and reach for Vonage Video. You want to go ahead and integrate voice or maybe send an SMS with a single use code or something like that. Vonage has APIs for that. They have a conversations API that's in beta, all kinds of really, really nifty APIs that make doing really impressive stuff in your app very, very easy. So I want you to check it out at vonage.dev/syntax. And you're going to get 10 euros of free credit when you are signing up. Thanks so much to Vonage for sponsoring.
Sick. All right. Next question is from Josiah. He actually wrote Josiah. So sorry for giving a soft J on that one. Hey guys, enter compliment about how great Wes and Scott and Syntax are. Thank you. Thank you, Josiah. Man, I'm going to do that soft J. I just landed my first web development job after following the Odin project and building out personal projects for about a year. I tripled my income and incredibly excited right before my second child is due as well. So the timing couldn't be any better. Well, congratulations.
Wow.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Anyway, as I work with two developers who have been working here for years, I have been using a PHP framework, which was developed by one of my coworkers with no documentation. In order to understand the code, I have to read a bunch of source and ask other developers questions. While I am doing well, I can't help but feeling like I'm working way too slow and asking too many questions. I assume this is imposter syndrome lots of people deal with, but how would you suggest dealing with this type of anxiety? I do love the show, by the way. Okay. So this is definitely something, especially when you have a system that's built by other people that's not documented. That's very common. And like a lot of the times people say, well, this thing isn't documented. Well, you know what? Anytime you work in a real team and in a real environment, you're going to find out that a lot of stuff in your team's, you know, playbook might not be up to the standards that you find in open source, because at the end of the day, you know, time is money here, and the managers and bosses don't really like care that much about giving developers time to test and document their code to the best. You know, it's not necessarily the highest priority beyond like getting it working and getting it shipping. Not to mean it shouldn't be, but it is. So that's very common to hit this type of code when you're working with internal teams. For me, I think one of the things that you should do is what you're doing by reading the source more. And it's going to always feel totally mystifying whenever you're diving into the source of any library, any project, anything that you didn't write yourself, somebody else wrote. This thing connects to this thing that connects to this thing, and you might not really get the big picture. It's going to feel like you're just trying things to get it to work for a little bit. But you're doing the right thing by asking questions. If it's not documented like crazy, I highly doubt that they are expecting you to be a master at this thing right away. So Yeah. You're doing the right stuff there. And I think if you continue to practice reading the source, you continue to talk to these people, not only are you going to become better at reading the source, you're going to feel more comfortable in this code base, but I think it's going to help you long-term being able to dive into projects and being like less reliant on text to document things and more reliant on, all right, let me read how these functions work together and how the system works together in the code itself. To me, that was like such a huge step in my career when I found out that you could go into these GitHub repos and just paw around and see how it actually works. And sometimes it's different than how you would have wrote it, so it's kind of hard to read, but it really always increases your skill and ability to spend that time really looking at the code and putting it together yourself. And if you do that, you can always document while you do that. That could help.
Yeah, I agree. I also like run into the situation myself when you're jumping into an existing project that somebody else has written the entire thing and you're expected to work on it. And you're like, well, like this is not some open source thing where I have a lot of experience in it. This is some in-house thing that then there's no documentation for it. So that's totally normal. No matter like where your skill level is at, you will be having to sit down with the devs of this and be like, look, I need you to pair program with me on this, or I need to be able to sit down and explain the ideas of how this stuff works. And probably after a couple months of doing that type of thing, you'll get much quicker at it and you'll be able to understand how these things work. Those devs should be willing to do it. Although I know that there are many senior devs who are more, they just feel like sort of annoyed that they have to explain this type of thing to someone. But I think any good developer worth their weight should be willing to explain how this stuff works. It's like, I think about it, like for me, I would be stoked to have another dev working on stuff with me, and I would really want them to code in the way that I would want them to code and the ideas behind the whole project. So that is pretty key. So I would just like sit down with your main dev and say, hey, like, what do you expect from me in order to, when I don't know how to do something in this code base, like, what do you expect from me? Do you expect me to like spend a couple hours reading the source, or should I reach out to you? At what point should I reach out to you? I feel like I'm bugging you sometimes, like, and just get that all out in the clear so that there's no
animosity. Hard feelings.
Yeah, just get that out in the clear so there's no like animosity or anything around that.
Yeah. You know what? Also, too, like, if I were you, these people have probably been working on this thing a long time, and they probably have some degree of attachment to the code, like personal attachment or even like attached to their ego because they were involved in the creation of it, most likely. So make sure that you're cognizant of people's feelings in that regard. And like when I'm looking at other people's code that like they're bringing to me, it's never like this sucks or this is no good or this is poorly documented or whatever. It's like always come at it from a more positive angle. How can I make this documentation for this project better? How can I understand this better? Like really take into consideration that, you know, humans wrote this code, and by insulting the code or whatever, you might be insulting those humans. Not to say you are, but just to have that in your mind is always important. All right, next question is from our big orange cat who hates Mondays, Garfield. Garfield asks about monorepos. Yes or no? I've thought about monorepos. Our site's a monorepo. We have our API and our build tool and our packages. We have like a form library. We have our UI. They're all separated into different projects that live inside of our monorepo. And monorepos, in my experience, have largely been a huge pain, but I wouldn't not do it. So for me, it's a worthwhile pain to keep everything co-located, especially our project. Sometimes I really dislike it in open source work, but I can understand why they chose to do it that way. Like it's really annoying when you have, you know, 20 packages under one monorepo and then the GitHub issues are just a total mess, right? But for my own work where it's not public like that, I like having everything co-located. And some hosting services and some CLIs and some things are a little bit more difficult. You could always reach for a tool like NX or Lerna or something like that. I chose not to because those tools had a lot of overhead. And at the end of the day, it was never really worth it for us. But I do see how they could be useful. You know what? I'm into monorepos. I don't know if you've been following along. Jared Palmer has, it's like Turbo Repo or something like that. I could be totally butchering the name right now. He's working on some new mono repo thing. So give him a follow on Twitter. If I butchered the name, so sorry, Jared. Hit me up with whatever it's called. I can't find it right now. But he's working on something, and I got my eyes on it because, you know, I'm not super happy with any of the tools, mostly just because they require some level of buy-in, or I've tried to use some of them in the past, and they don't play well with custom setups, or they're made for very specific setups. So for me, I'm into it, but I wrote all my own tools for ours. And, you know, not everybody has the time or energy to do that.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of them as well. If you want to check out a really nice one, go to KeystoneJS's repo. And it's really cool because they have a massive monorepo with probably 30 different packages in there. And every single field type is its own package, which is really cool because they are essentially using their own APIs to create these fields. And if you wanted to make your own field input, you would just have to take a look at one of the examples that they have there. Like there's an auto increment field or authentication relationship field or all these different types of fields that they have in there. And when you're hacking on one of the fields that is in it, it's really easy just to clone the entire monorepo. And if you need changes to three or four packages all at the same time, then you can just, there's just folders and you can just edit them. And it's really, really simple. And it's not easy to get the stuff up and running, but as somebody who has worked on projects that are already set up in monorepos, definitely enjoy that. Gatsby's the same way. If you take a look at Gatsby's repo, they have a packages directory. They probably have close to 100 different packages in the repo. They can publish them all at once. You can also track changes via commit histories. If you're using conventional commits, you can automatically generate all that type of stuff. So just because of the way JavaScript is in that everything is always just this tiny little package, it would be a nightmare to have to try to, like, I don't know, if you wanted to open up an issue on one of 100 GitHub repos, that'd be very, very difficult. And if you need to work on something where you are touching three or four different repos at once, it makes it super simple.
Yeah. You know, I'm looking at their monorepo right now and I cannot find...
Which one?
Keystone's monorepo on GitHub. It's using Yarn workspaces, which have now come to NPM, by the way. But other than that, I like can't find if it's using... It doesn't look like it's using Lerna or NX, or any of the sort of popular ones. So I'm trying to just see if they are using something to manage their mono repo besides their own, just like their own scripts, but I don't see anything. So that's neat.
Yeah. All there is just, if you look at the build command,
scripts and workspaces and yeah.
Yeah. Just using that. So
yeah,
we should have Jed from Keystone on to ask about that as well as some other questions I have. Next question from, how do you say this one? Jarek, as a brand new self-taught developer, how would you know if you're ready to apply for a junior position? This is a question we get a lot. Mm-hmm. We just did a past show on like hireable skills in 2021. And I got some like really good DMs about that. Actually, people are like, oh, thank you. Like I was having trouble figuring out really what to focus on. But the question of like, how do I know if I'm ready to start to go ahead and apply for these junior positions is a really interesting one. And I think we've answered this before in that you can just go ahead and try and see if you start getting interviews or if you don't. I would say if you have a good grasp on your fundamentals, you're able to use a couple frameworks here or there, and you've got three or four decent things in your portfolio, I'd say that's a pretty good target to reach.
Yeah. And I'm just going to say, you are ready, apply for it. It doesn't matter. If you don't get the job, then you got experience in that kind of interview that's going to inform you in your next interview of the same level. You know, when I first got my very first dev job, I really thought it was above my skill level. I had only done sites for freelance clients or myself, and I had never had a professional dev job. I didn't go to a boot camp. They didn't even exist. So it was like, I just did not think I was ready. And my wife convinced me that it was my dream job and that I needed to go for it. I was working as an audiovisual projectionist at the university. And like, I was just like, there's no way they're going to hire me when there's other developers. And then sure enough, I wrote a really good cover letter. I, you know, did the best to explain why I'm passionate about, you know, what I do or why I really like what I do and the effort that I put into it. And they gave me a chance. It allowed me to develop the skills that I wouldn't have developed any other way. And that opened the door to just about every other career opportunity that I've ever had. So apply for it. I had to be convinced to apply for my first dev job and I got it. So not to say that you will get it or whatever. It doesn't matter if you do or don't. You need that experience applying and talking to professionals to see what they want to see out of you. All right. Next question is from Lassie Norfelt. Okay. Will there ever be a .eat domain or are pre-order sites just ripping you off? Would like to know who decides what domain suffix are possible or not. So he's saying that he received or there's like a pre-order available for a domain, for a .eat domain. And they're wondering if, is that like a thing that I can be confident that this will ever exist? Now, I don't have a ton of insight in here, but I know you are big into this, Wes.
Yeah, I don't know specifically if there's going to be a .eat, but the question of, like, there's all these new TLDs, top-level domains. Can anyone just go ahead and, like, make one? So this is under the authority of ICANN, which stands for, what is it? The Internet Corporation for Assigned Names. And they're basically the people behind who allows to have a dot lawyer or dot accountant. And in the last, I don't know, 8 years or so, we've seen just a huge swath of new TLDs come up. There's two types of TLDs. There's GTLDs, global top level domains, and then there's CCTLDs, which is country code TLDs. And anybody is allowed to apply to make up a new global TLD. And I actually looked into it. The process is there's a huge process. You got to apply, you have to show your business model, you got to show like 3-year revenue projections, whole bunch of information about that. But at the end of the day, it costs $185,000 US to apply. And then a $5,000 deposit fee when you are registering. The deposit is credited against the evaluation fee. Other fees may apply depending on the specific application path. If you go on the ICANN's website, you can download this huge PDF that actually shows you what the whole process is. So if I wanted a .wes domain name, I could go ahead and apply for it. I doubt that they would give it to me because I don't really have a business behind selling these types of domain names. but certainly anybody is allowed to do that. We also see a lot of people apply for them and then just not offer them up. I think you don't have to sell them in order to get a TLD, because I think I remember there being like a .coke or something like that. Let me look it up. The TLD operator may choose not to sell second level registrations, meaning somebody can buy a .coke and pay to maintain it and they can use it themselves, but they don't have to allow other people to be able to use them with .coke. So kind of interesting. Maybe we should get a .syntax. Anybody want to chip in? If there was one word that you would be allowed to use for a .tld, what would it be?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. I have never, ever, ever thought about it.
I would probably get .boss. How sick would that be? West.boss?
I'm going to get .talinsky, okay? How sick would that be?
Is there like a limit to the number of characters?
The limit's probably shorter than Talinsky.
Well, I think there's .accountants. Let's find out what the longest one is.
While you are doing that, I will read the next question.
Okay.
All right. This next question is from Kevin. He says, Scott and Wes, really enjoyed the podcast. I'm currently employed as a full stack developer, but want to build a portfolio for job hunting. Would you say it's okay to reference a project or two from an employer? My problem is that the only projects I have outside are mostly smaller build tools for myself for fun. Would love to hear your thoughts on this. Kevin, unless you are bound by an NDA, put all that stuff in your portfolio. Those are the things that hiring managers want to see. They care much less about your side projects than they do real client work. So like if I was looking at real client work compared to like some side projects, I would be like, okay, this is great. So yes, unless you are bound by an NDA that says you cannot show off that work, please show off that work. Put it in your portfolio.
Yeah, seriously, just go for it. It's so key to be able to show real world work rather than just like everybody has sample projects and silly things that they've built, but showing that you've actually worked on real world stuff, I don't know, just go for it. Ask for permission later, maybe.
What is it? Ask for forgiveness rather than ask for permission?
Yes. Yeah. All right, Scott, I have answers for you on the longest TLD available.
Let's hear it.
It is 12 characters long. .construction.
Okay.
And the second longest one, .contractors, followed by .accountants. And then the shortest one are just two letters, .es. W.es would be a really cool domain name.
So, okay, while you were saying this, I decided that mine would be .dope.
Oh, that would be good.
Scott.dope. I'll take it.
That's great. Oh, I like it.
One of our sponsors actually has a neat little domain, sanity.io. I always like that, sanity.io. That's a really cool domain. Wes, I know that you just did the last ad read, but you really love talking about Sanity. Do you want to talk about Sanity?
I do want to talk about Sanity. Sanity is a structured content CMS used by massive companies all around the world, small companies all around the world, Cloudflare, Nike, National Geographic, Sonos, Condé Nast, Figma.
West Boss.
That's just my own tutorial on Gatsby uses Sanity. And it's an awesome headless CMS, which means that you sign up for Sanity, you clone your demo project, or you start a new project with a blank slate. Go ahead and you create your schemas, which is a word I'd love to say, and which is your data types. And each data type will have fields. Each data type can have relationships, one to many, many to many, things like that. That's really where some of these CMSs and specifically Sanity will shine, is when you have many to many relationships and you update them on either side. The question is, does the other side update? Because sometimes you go into CMSs and you're like, no, you have to update it only on one side. Like a person can be related to movies, but if you go to a movie and change the people that are in that movie, like it doesn't sync both ways. Mm-hmm. And Sanity does an awesome job. But actually, they have a really good movie example that you should check out for yourself. Then once you've made your CMS, you can host the thing yourself. You can make your own custom React inputs if you want. And then once you have that, out the other end, you get an API endpoint. They have this really cool thing called Grok, which is a query language to query the different types of data you want. You can also use GraphQL with them, and you can integrate it with literally anything that can fetch some JSON. So like your React application, Gatsby, Next.js, Vue, you name it. So check it out, sanity.io/syntax. That's going to get you double the free usage tier. Thanks so much to Sanity for sponsoring.
Nice. All right, next question. What's my name again? Hey guys, love the show. My life would be incomplete without it. Sincerely, obligatory comment out of the way, winky face. All right, here's my question. Should developers always use their real first name and last name when presenting themselves as professional online? Twitter, LinkedIn, GitHub, personal site, etc. Or is it acceptable to use a fake last name? My wife is conscious about privacy online, so would prefer I retain some anonymity. But also, my last name is generic, not very Googleable, thinking John Smith. I thought having a more snappy, interesting name would help me stand out and be easier to find in a quick Google. You guys are both awesome names and very unique and hard to forget. I would say that Wes's name is unique and hard to forget. I would not necessarily say that my last name is, because
everybody spells his name with a Y.
Everybody thinks I'm Russian. Yeah, because I spelled my name with a Y. But yeah, no, I, you know what? This is an interesting question, because I thought about this too, because like, me personally, Talensky, not easy to spell. My entire life, it seems easy to spell for me, but my entire life, people have been spelling it incorrectly, like since I was 2 years old. You know, it's just always, you always have to spell it out for people. And so at some point, like maybe like 4 years after I got into this, I was like, man, I really should have come up with a fake name, because for no reason other than like, Wes Boss is 6 characters. That is less characters than my entire last name. So like, that seems like that could have been a really good opportunity. Like, I have no idea what kind of fake last name I could have come up with. But if I could go back in time, I might do it just for that alone, just to have it snappier and easier to come up with. But what's funny is that all of the people I know with like really cool names, like that's their real name. Like, I don't know anybody with a really like buttoned up cool name like Wes Boss. They're not their real name. So I don't know. I might do it myself, but yeah, who knows?
I went to school with Steve O, which is, he was Asian. And I think his last name was just the letter O. Like, that literally his last name was just O.
Yeah.
And he could never sign up for stuff, because everybody was like, hey, put your full last name, not just the initial. And he'd be like, it is my actual last name. Not to mention that his name was Steve-O. Like,
yeah.
That's
all. Yeah.
I would say absolutely, both from a privacy standpoint, like I'm okay with having my name out there, but yeah, like it is a bit of a privacy thing at the end of the day, if somebody knows your entire name, and you could possibly get into some hot water with that. Especially also like if there's like a serial killer with the same last name as you, or there's somebody in the same industry with the same name as you. Like sometimes you search for somebody and you find 2 developers with this exact same name, and that could like muddy the water, because if somebody does something bad or writes a blog post that is not good, they could accidentally be attributed onto you, and then the mob will be on you. So I can see why wanting to be both unique and as well as have privacy. I think it'd be really cool. Like, we've had David K. Piano on the thing, and everybody knows his name, and his last name is not Piano. What's his last name?
Kershaw.
Yeah. See, we would not say his full name. We would just say David, the state machine's David, if we didn't know his last name.
I would kind of like look at some of my state code, and I would just like look at it for a second, and all of a sudden David would pop in, because he knows that it should be in a state machine instead.
Yeah, definitely go and make your own cool. I would probably use my first name. And then make up like a cool last name, like Scotty Sniper or something like that. Make sure you can get the domain name. Make sure you can get the Twitter handle, the Instagram. Go full rebrand.
You could go like
on a cool last name.
Hypermask and say like Scott Steele, Scott Maximum.
Scott Maximum.
Wait, what's a Scott CEO? That's better than a boss, right?
Scott Doc Construction.
Scott Doc. Yes. That's so very good. All right. Next question is from an anonymous. It says, how do you find time to work and keep up with updates and libraries while having jobs, wives and kids? That's not what they, I that was a little freestyle on what they wrote, but it was having a wife and kids. You know what? It's our job. That's really how we do it. A lot of people get like, they see us and they say like, oh man, you guys are on top of different stuff. Not only are we not on top of all these different things, for instance, the server React component episode has sat in our to-dos for a little while because Wes and I just don't have the time to prepare for you just yet.
Yeah.
So there's that aspect of it. One, it's our job to be up on this stuff. So don't feel bad if it's not your job to be up on this stuff and you're, you know, doing a lot of other things. Two, it's not easy, man. Now I'm working 40 hours a week, but for the past year, I've only been working 20 hours a week. So 20 hours a week to record a tutorial series every month, to update the dev in the site constantly, to record syntax is not a lot. And I have just been barely keeping my head above water. So if it seems like everybody is up on it and everybody's on top of it, chances are that's not the case.
Sometimes you see these kids who are up on literally everything, but that's not the case. Most people don't have that much time to keep up on it. The whole point of this podcast is you just listen to this podcast. Maybe you follow a bunch of people on Twitter, and that should be enough to try to keep your ear to the ground. And once you start hearing us talk about things, we always say, if you hear about us talk about something 16 times, then it's time for you to start looking into this type of thing. Otherwise, that's what the podcast is for. You just like, we talk about stuff and you hear it top of mind and you go on a walk the dog, go on a car ride. And just like through that, you're being able to keep up to date on this type of stuff. You don't have to go ahead and build stuff in it. You just have to know about it. And then when it comes time to needing a specific piece of tech, you'll have like, okay, I understand what it does and how it works. Now let me actually get into the nitty gritty of understanding how to write the code to do this thing.
Word.
Next question from Tikaram Marty. Hey, Wes and Scott. I am a beginner making course content. I am trying to create a programming tutorial, but every time I record tutorials, I have compromise on audio quality. Lots of background noises get captured on audio. I have a noisy neighborhood. Can you share some tips to make a soundproofing room? What trick do both of you use? Yeah, this is a good one. And this is honestly, I think, a bit of a competitive advantage for me is that like I have a really, really good room that is very quiet and I'm able to record in it whenever I have time to do that. And it's not like I have to be like, all right, I'm going to schedule in recording and make sure the kids are out of the house and all that stuff. I can just turn it on. So some tips for you is most noises that come into your microphone are not noises, they're vibrations. So people walking across the thing, a loud truck rolling by, you can get rid of a lot of those vibrations. The biggest one is typing on your keyboard and the vibrations go directly into your microphone. So the easiest way to do that, get a little shock mount for your microphone. They're, I don't know, $30 or so. Put a t-shirt underneath your keyboard that will dampen a lot of the sound. And then past that, the DBX 286 is a what, preprocessor? Is that what you call it?
It's a pre.
What do you call it?
I did. Well, it's just such a web developer thing, a preprocessor.
Well, hold on. It says preamp. So it's a preamplifier. And basically what it will do is it takes out a lot of those things where, like, just right now, I don't know if you're able to hear that, but there's a baby monitor 2 feet away. Scott, did you hear the baby monitor go off? I just got up and went. See?
No.
Like, the baby monitor, my wife turned on the sound machine and put our kid to bed, and it started going, and I walked over and turned it off, and Scott didn't even hear it in it, and it's sitting, like, 2 meters away from my microphone. Why? That's because the preamp takes all that sound out of it, takes a lot of that background noise out. I can have a truck roll by. So I'll often have my windows open in the summer. I can hear the kids screaming from there's a school down the road. A lot of that can just be taken out with a nice Nice quality preamp. Past that, Scott, you have a pretty noisy environment as well. How do you do it?
Yeah, and if it goes to show you anything, there is a literal tree cutter outside my neighbor's house right now cutting down a tree this entire episode. So if that hasn't ruined your life while listening to this, then yeah, my setup is good. Well, okay, here's the deal. We're in an old house, 1920s house, single pane glass windows, original windows. The ceiling on them is absolutely terrible. And you can hear everything. Like a child yells for a second outside and it's going to come into my office. So this DBX-286 is the thing. Being nice and close to your microphone and having those gates and set up so that, you know, your microphone is only going to catch, but also the compression to be able to pull out any of those background sounds. Either way, if you are recording in a noisy environment, this thing will make your life better. Another thing, dynamic microphone. Don't get compressor. Why am I blanking on the word? A powered mic. I don't know why I'm blanking on the word. All that's coming to me is cardioid. I don't know. I don't know why I'm blanking on this. I have one and it picks up way too much sound. So either way, get a Wes microphone like Wes and I have. I have the Electrovoice RE20 and a microphone that's made for maybe noisier environments rather than something like that's going to pick up a ton of sound. Making this microphone switch and the 286 was the biggest
condenser thing
for me. Condenser. Why couldn't I think of that? I was just thinking compressor. Compressor. That's probably the biggest things. My room is way too noisy. So what are your tips on soundproofing your room? Unless you have the ability to build a room within a room and you have the ability to do major construction, don't even consider it. You know, you'll want to maybe put up some sound deadeners. One thing that I did is think about like airflow. Anytime there's airflow into your room, our doors are really old, but even underneath the door. So I put in a rubber door sweep and then I clogged the keyhole. That's like a basically just an open hole into the rest of my house. So I have found the areas where airflow comes into my room and I've largely shut them down to be able to deaden out some of that sound, but you're not going to be able to solve all of it. My best friend is an audio engineer. He came into my office and was just like, yeah, you don't really have a ton of options. So like, here's what you can do to make it better, but it's not going to be perfect by any means. So don't worry too much about it. Let these things just help you. And also, Wes, you said sound is vibration. Vibration is sound. That reminds me of one of my favorite songs. I'm sparked, waiting for the dark to hit. Because once moves gives my apartment, I catch fits for starting. Beep. I'm smart with it. I give it that special touch when I push it because I'm also label rep and I can't allow no beep.
What?
So song. Sound is...
It's one of your favorite songs?
Sound is vibration. So shush, kid. Shush, baby. Shut your eyes. Lay your head back. Shed the tears and let the tears crystallize. Oh, man. Us rapping on the show is really pinnacle.
No. It's very good.
It's very good.
What else is very good, Scott?
The best error and exceptional handling service to capture all of your errors and exceptions and handle them and even give you performance notes, like a user misery score. I'm talking about Sentry. That's sentry.io. Use the coupon code TASTYTREAT, all lowercase, all one word, and you'll get 2 months for free. Now, Sentry at sentry.io really, really, really saves my bacon all the time. We pushed a pretty substantial update to a level up and the API a couple weeks ago, and we were watching Sentry, and all of a sudden, you see those big purple bars spike up, and I'm just like, ooh, something's wrong here. And it turns out it was just a miscommunication between when the API, we had a new version of the API that was incompatible with the new version of the UI. And, you know, when you're building both of them and pushing them both live, there was like a discrepancy of like maybe a minute or so in the difference between. But in that minute, there was a bunch of errors. And so what Sentry allowed us to do really quickly was to see that this little spike almost looked like a bell curve of when this started and when it ended. It allowed us to see really quickly that this was not anything that we needed to drop and fix or wasn't anything that we needed to freak out about. It was just a temporary disruption. And one of the things I love about Sentry is they give you not only just, it's not just like a big table of all of your errors, but they give you these visual cues and visual tools and all sorts of different ways to be able to see it. Even their user misery chart for how long routes take to load is like a visual thing. And for somebody like me, I love seeing these kind of charts and figures and all this stuff about what things I need to worry about, when I need to be concerned with it. So head on over to sentry.io, use the coupon code TASTYTREAT, all lowercase, all one word, get 2 months for free.
All right, next question from Kirky. As someone who recently learned and is learning how to build websites with Node, Express, and React with a little bit of Django on top, how did you start building a portfolio that isn't just a bunch of practices / show pieces? How do I actually get clients? This is a really good question too, because a lot of the times people who are hiring, and we've heard this from people who are hiring, is like they see the same projects over and over again, a to-do list, a recipe, blog. They see the same things that everybody is building, and that stuff doesn't necessarily stand out. It's good to show that you can build these types of things, but really what they want to see is, oh, you did a tutorial or you learned something, and then something in your head goes, ah, but I could use that for X, Y, and Z. And I see this a lot when people take my courses, is they say, ah, okay, Wes, I got 80% of the way through your course. And then I said, I bet I can make something my own on this. And I love seeing that, because it's like, that's how you learn, right? Then you start diverging and using the tech you've built. And I didn't like this part of the tech, so I swapped it out and put my own piece in. And like, that's really where you start becoming your own. So what do I recommend for this type of thing is have a couple projects, 2 to 3, that are small enough that you can actually finish them. Like, they don't have to be massive project out there, but real enough and big enough that they're not the same example tutorial over again. So all I did right now is I just thought in 2 minutes, here are some examples of stuff that you could build. And I'm always thinking of example apps. So I should just make a list of 100 things at one point, but
we should do that.
Yeah. We should do a whole show on apps you could build.
Yeah.
A camera that takes you a picture every time there is motion. This is something I've done. So get a webcam, get an old laptop that you have sitting around or old Android phone, put it in the window, run WebRTC. And then whenever there's motion, or if you could even use a like one of these AI APIs where you send the photo to it and it will return to you like 80% confidence there is a car in this photo, or 80% confidence there is a FedEx in this, and then it will tell you, then you could text that. So you could, hey, you could use one of our sponsors today, Vonage, send an SMS, say, hey, there's a FedEx truck in the photo, right? That is something that would probably take a couple of days to actually build, but it just shows the person who is hiring you, this person has the type of mind that is always turning and thinking of new ideas. Another thing that came up this weekend was my daughters love to do coloring sheets. And sometimes they have pictures of, like, there's a picture of a fairy this weekend and they wanted that, but in a coloring sheet. So we have this app on our phone that basically just draws outlines of photos. It's like $10 and we don't pay for the app. We just screenshot it and print that. And I was like, somebody should build a web app with Canvas that does edge detection and then turns a regular photo into a coloring sheet, right? A chore generating chart, workout logger, something. After I posted my video on how I did shipping t-shirts, a couple of people said, hey, that's really cool how you did like the barcode scanning with the actual barcode scanner in web tech. I'm going to build something like that for my portfolio, because that's interesting, right? That's interesting to the person who's building it. That's also like, how many people have barcode scanning apps in their portfolio, mm-hmm. right? Scott's got a couple here. Go ahead.
Well, I did like a plant watering timer, right? I have all these I'm a house plant person, right? I'm one of those people. And I went to download an app that was advertised to me on Instagram that was like, well, this app will tell you when to water your plants. And like, oh, that's great. I could really use a reminder of when the last time I watered the plants was. But then I saw that they charge a monthly subscription for plant reminders.
Come on.
You could put this on a calendar and it would be the exact same. Like, I was this is absolutely absurd. And you know what? They have tons and tons of downloads and 5-star rankings. I'm just thinking, like, man, you could create a plant water timer in just about no time and charge some money for that. That's something that's like so easy.
A lot of people are probably listening and be like, well, there's already an app that does that. And like, it's fine if your app is not the same as like this like massive app that is already in the app store, or the website of Park Reviews is already, Google Reviews already does that. It doesn't matter if somebody's already done it. It just goes to show that you wanted to create your own thing and you went out and put the tech together and actually built this thing, even though if it doesn't have every single feature ever. It's kind of fun to have these little playgrounds for that. So that's what people listening need to do, is they need to just go and solve some of your own problems. Not the ideas that I just had, because those are my problems. Those are things that I'm excited about. But like, what do you need solved in your life? Go ahead and do that.
All of these have always been that for me. Like I wrote a tool to help me remember the dance moves I have for my breaking battles. In breaking, if you do the same move twice, it's really seen as being bad in the eyes of the judges. And so I would always be like, huh, did I do that in the first round? I don't remember. I have to check the footage if I did that or not for some reason because I have a bad memory. So I made an app that allowed me to list all of my dance moves and sort them by difficulty and allow me to just check them off whenever I use them. And I was like, people at competitions would be like, man, what is that? What do you got? And just be like, oh, I just made it. Like, it's just being run on my local server. Yeah. So, I mean, just like little things like that, right? Solve your own problems. And again, I thought you had a really great point about, you know, if you're following a tutorial, just tweak it a little bit. I used to even go as far as like, if you are too fresh to be able to really understand how to tweak it a lot, even just changing the names of things gets your brains working in a little bit. Like if somebody's doing a to-do app, which is the most basic thing, then make it be a resolutions app or just something like that. I've always done that to make it just a little bit different so you're not copying and pasting. You're having to actually put a little bit of a brain power into it. Last question for today is from John. So we got John and Garfield. Where's Odie? We got to get Odie in here.
Odie, somebody submit a question from Odie, please.
Please. We need the rest of the gang. All right, John Arbuckle. No, just John says, should I be using multiple web apps on a single site or try to make them all one? If I have a site that displays blog posts about a project about parks, for example, then a page with all the parks listed out, that link to a page about a specific park details. Should I be making the entire thing one app or just make a blog post or blog app and publish it, then make a different app for the other content and publish it to a subdomain? Love the show. Y'all are a big part of why I keep at it and keep learning. All right. So I have intimate experience with this. For instance, Level Up Tutorials has a blog. Level Up Tutorials has a store. And a couple of these things used to be their own web apps. For instance, the store used to be a completely separate web app, a separate domain that ran on the same database as the site, moved them together. The blog was originally written as a Gatsby site, just using similar CSS or the same CSS. But I was really annoyed with having to maintain so many different separate projects. And at some point it's like, oh yeah, you know what? Creating a blog is going to be kind of tough, but it's not going to be that tough for our needs. I don't need this blog to be Medium or WordPress level of features. I don't need it to be like that intense. I just need it to be able to display posts and data was posted and who was posted by and the title and a listing and an archive or whatever. And for me, I went from having all of these things broken out into services to bringing them all under one umbrella and having them all run as one app. So for me, how I would do it, I would have them all be one app because I have been to the edge and back and done the many separate apps and it was a PIA.
I'm going to go the opposite and say, keep your marketing. I'm assuming the blog is more of a marketing place. Keep your marketing and your actual app separate because the marketing people love to dip their toes into the blog and add all these.
Well, it depends on if you got marketing people. I don't got marketing.
It's true. If you don't have marketing people, then maybe. Yeah, it's just another content type with the title field and the input field and things like that. But if you want to run A-B tests, then all of that stuff is not muddying up your actual application logic. That can be done on a totally separate platform that moves at maybe a different pace than that type of thing. And that's pretty popular. Like you look at any, let's look at our three sponsors today. Sanity.io, their blog is, I'm going to open them all up. One sec.
The Log Rocket's blog is its own thing. You know what? You know what Log Rocket should call their blog? They have it as blog.logrocket.com. They should call it Blog Rocket.
I know. What the heck?
It looks like this is a WordPress. Log Rockets is a WordPress, which their app obviously is a WordPress.
So I'm just looking at it. It seems like, yeah, Sanity's app is at manage.sanity.io, but their marketing website's at sanity.io. Sentry's app is located on the same one. Let me see. Nope. The blog is at blog.sentry.io and the app is at sentry.io. And Vonage has their blog on a different domain than their actual. They have a lot more products. So I'm assuming they have even more than two services out there. So most of these big companies will put their blog and their marketing on a separate subdomain. It's important to keep it on the same subdomain because you can, if you do need to integrate stuff, like, you know, you maybe need to pull a list of services or data from your actual application, then you can just surface that stuff via an API endpoint. And especially if it's on the same domain, you can still, you can even show the user if they're logged in or not in the title bar, even if it's two totally different apps because it's on the same domain.
It makes cores easier. It makes HTTPS easier. Makes all that stuff easier.
Yeah. All that. Yeah. Never do different domains like I'm doing. It's very tough. I think that's it for today. Thank you so much to everyone for submitting your questions. Those are awesome. Let's get into some sick picks for today.
Sick picks. Do you have one handy?
I do. I'm going to sick pick my new soldering iron, soldering iron. It's a Miniware TS80P, and it's a really, really slick, tiny little, like, I'm going to show you. It's maybe like 3 inches big, this little tiny soldering iron. And it has a tip that goes in it. It uses a headphone jack to plug in as a tip. It's all metal, really nice constructed. And the sort of the killer feature of the TS80P is that it can be powered off of USB, which means you can't just like use your like dollar store charger on it because it takes 30 watts. But if you have one of these nice power banks that does power delivery or quick charge, or if you've got the USB-C charger from your MacBook, all of those will give you enough juice in order to power this thing. And being able to have a wireless soldering setup is so, so nice. Like the stuff that you need to solder, you're either sitting at like a kitchen table and there's no plugs available, yeah, or like for me, I'm soldering a bunch of stuff on wires on my ATV, and like you're in, maybe you're doing it on the driveway and you have to run an extension cord, things like that. It's such a pain. So it's not the most powerful soldering iron ever, but for the type of like little wire and small electronic stuff I'm doing, it's been awesome so far. I'm really, really excited about having a nice tiny little, and also it has like a hackable firmware. Mm-hmm. So you can like set like custom firmwares on it. And it's like the Linksys router of soldering irons. Really, really cool. So check it out. It's a Miniware TS80P. I'll put a link in the show notes for it.
I've been getting into hacking my, you can see my Remarkable tablet here. I've been getting into hacking my Remarkable tablet.
Oh, what have you been doing to it?
Well, it turns out you can SSH into it really easily. And it makes it like I can replace, like, for instance, all I did to get this like sleep screen on it, I'm showing Wes, I got like an elevation. This is actually Denver. So this is the Rocky That's Mountains so cool. in Denver. And it's the sleep screen I did just by copying the old image and moving a new image onto it. You know, what is the SCP? By moving an image onto it. And it's pretty neat. I'm very concerned about goofing it up because you do get like full root access, like straight up. And I don't want to goof up anything, but I'm taking little baby steps. People like hack in to this thing and add new apps. Like they've added like crosswords and Sudoku and a bunch of like interesting little things here to it. So my sick pick today, Wes, is going to be the Camlink 4K. In the episode about our desk setups, I had a bunch of people message me. They'd be like, my Camlink allows me to plug everything in with one port. And great, cool. Mine does not. However, I began to look into it, and I had the Camlink, the old Camlink, which came out before the 4K existed. Well, I was like, you know what? It's worth it to me, and I actually use this over on my Nintendo Switch. So having two of them in the house, I can be okay with that sunk cost. It's not like it's just a useless replacement. Also, my camera is a 4K camera, so having a 4K Camlink seems like it's probably the best idea. So I got the 4K Camlink, and it works. It's plugged into my CalDigit 3T, and I got a new cable for my external USB-C monitor, and I now have my entire setup my cam link, my monitor, everything. One cable coming out of that CalDigit.
It's the dream.
It's the dream. This is exactly what I was complaining about in the last episode. So the cam link 4K, for those of you who don't know, it basically looks like a USB key. One end is an HDMI. The other end is USB, and it allows anything that has an HDMI clean signal to come into your computer. We use it for not only using my fancy cam as a webcam, but also streaming Nintendo Switch games over Zoom so my whole family can play them. So stuff like that. Yeah, so that's what I use the Cam Link 4K for. It is so easy. You plug it in, it works, it's fantastic. I love this little thing. And yeah, that's my sick pick.
I'm just thinking back to the days when I had a component out on one of my video cards. I remember I hooked it up to like an old CRT TV and it was just like, this is amazing. Mm-hmm. I've been waiting my whole life to be able to hook a computer up to a TV or vice versa. You can have like a capture card where you hook your camcorder up to it and play it back at real mm-hmm. time and capture that value. Things have gotten a lot better. The 4K Cam Link is been awesome. Yeah, I have it and I plug it into a powered hub. And the thing is just rock solid for me.
Yeah, rock solid. All right, shameless plugs. I'm going to shamelessly plug the latest level up tutorials course, which is called Node Fundamentals Authentication. And I've already gotten a ton of great feedback on it. People saying that this course really takes its time giving you all of the in-depth parts of writing your own authentication system. And we're doing it from scratch as an exercise to show you that it's not as mystical and mystifying as people may have led you to believe. We talk all about the differences between encryption, salting, and hashing. One of the videos is WTF is a JWT. And we have a lot of fun stuff like that. So we really take our time explaining all of the concepts. We use HTTP only secure cookies, all sorts of neat stuff. We talk about sessions and validating sessions, refreshing sessions. And guess what? The course for March, by the time you're listening to this course will already be out, is part two to Node Fundamentals Authentication, where we dive into even more authentication topics and things like 2FA, verifying emails. It's going to go on and on. So if you really enjoyed the Node Fundamentals course, there is part two coming at you, Cleopatra, in March, end of March, March 31st. So shout out leveluptutorials.com/pro. Sign up for 1 year and save 25%.
I'll shamelessly plug my courses, specifically my latestly updated one, Full Stack Advanced React and GraphQL. We teach you everything you need to know to build a full stack app with React on the front end, GraphQL on the front end, Apollo, Keystone on the back end. It is awesome. Check it out, advancedreact.com, and you can use the coupon code SYNTAX for 10 bucks off. All right, I think that is it. Thank you so much for tuning in. We will catch you on Monday. Peace.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.